Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our multi-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
Well, hello, Susan. Now, where are we going this week?
When I was in Webster City last week, I discovered that an important part of the story of the revival of their downtown is their population of immigrants, starting with the Lao people who came in the 1970s. In this program, we'll explore how Webster City is benefiting from their presence, as well as providing important welcoming services. We have several people who will tell that story. Then we'll talk with Peter Fisher, economics professor emeritus from University of Iowa, who will give us the data on exactly how immigrants affect the economy of Iowa. We'll end with a couple of announcements of upcoming events.
And now, where do you want to begin?
I'd like to go back to Deb Brown at the Webster City Chamber of Commerce. I asked her if there were immigrant communities in Webster City, and this is what she told me.
We have a Hispanic community here, and we have a Laotian community here. We get along just beautifully. We're working at diversity and getting to know each other and enjoying each other's businesses and company.
Can you tell what attracted these two communities to the area?
I can, actually. Governor Robert Ray, back in the day, helped to bring in immigrants from the Vietnamese and South Asia area, and the Laotians were part of that choice, and the churches embraced it quite openly. So that's how we got our Laotian community here back in the 70s. And the Hispanic community has just been growing. It's a place, Webster City is centrally located. It's a great place to do business. We have companies that hire people. And why wouldn't they want to stay and live with us?
Well, you said companies that hire people. Used to be those were packing plants. But now, is there a difference?
There is. There absolutely is. For example, there's Marianne's Foods. There's Webster City Custom Meats, so they actually produce the food that you find on the shelves. The packing plants of the old day are long gone. They are no longer the same. The technology is so advanced, and the way things are done is totally different. There's a new plant coming to Wright County, which is about 12 miles from here. We anticipate some growth from that company as well.
And, of course, this affects your choice of restaurants, I imagine.
As far as what food there is to eat, yeah, absolutely. That's why we have such a good choice of different kinds of food, because it's not just, you know, sandwiches and pizza, although we have lovely places for that. But you can get a steak, you can get Mexican food, you can go to All Cultures Equal and experience Laotian food. Lots of wide choices in our community.
Well, you know, this brings up my own experience, Susan. I was in management with the Iowa Employment Security Commission, known as Job Service. We worked with Governor Ray back in the 70s when we had the big influx of Southeast Asian refugees. Governor Ray made a commitment to take in a huge number of what were referred to as boat people. They were folks who had been in refugee camps in the Philippines and other areas, who've come to the United States, and only California took more people than Iowa. So Governor Ray got all the agency heads together and said, we're going to take in a lot of these folks here in Iowa. And, of course, working with job placement, we were a key agency to help these folks find jobs. And it was a wonderful effort, a groundswell of activity from people all over the state. Churches were sponsoring families. And, of course, we handled job placement. There were a lot of folks who were in entry-level jobs who were highly educated. They were people who were college graduates who were glad to have a job as a janitor or an entry-level job, which is typical of an immigrant population. And, of course, they all eventually found jobs more appropriate for their station in life. But it was a fantastic experience, and I'll never forget that. We had all kinds of folks who had really experienced great privation, both at sea and in the refugee camps. And here they were, safely ensconced in Iowa. And I remember making phone calls to let people know we had an interview for them. And it was such a typical immigrant family experience that was also verified in my Norwegian background, where the children were assimilated more quickly. And so if we'd call for an adult to go on a job interview, there was always a pause, and then a child came to the phone because they were going to interpret the directions to go to the job interview for that adult. And that just verifies my own experience. My mother had no brogue at all. My Norwegian grandmother never lost her brogue and was barely bilingual. So every immigrant group has the same experience, and we were delighted to be part of that at Job Service of Iowa because we were dealing with something very concrete, finding them a job. And they were wonderful folks, and I want to compliment all the churches and social service agencies who assisted them. Clearly, that's what happened at one moment or another in Webster City, where you're talking with these people, too.
Yes, we'll hear a little more detail about what happened in Webster City. One thing I don't think I have on the tapes that we're using is that was when Electrolux was a big employer in Webster City. And one of the characteristics of the Lao people and perhaps others in from Southeast Asia was that they were very detail-oriented and very dexterous. So they were really very appropriate employees.
Oh, to do the assembly work and the sort
That's
of things
right.
you have to do to assemble that equipment.
Yeah. And when Electrolux closed and most of the workers left, the Lao people did not leave because it was home. And we'll hear more stories about that in a little bit. The director of the All Cultures Equal Center, also called the ACE Center, Janet Turing, will give us a little more background for that. And she'll also introduce Doug Bailey, who can tell us how he got involved.
Around 2000, I believe, a group of people were recognizing that the Laotian population and the Hispanic population and other cultures needed a place, a community center to learn and to grow and to test their wings here in the United States that they feel safe at and good at. And this is an old, I think it was like Shopper Supply kind of building, and so they expanded it just a little bit, and everybody worked on it on a volunteer basis to build it. And Doug Bailey was one of the founders, and he is what, and his wife, who she's a teacher, he's a board of supervisors. We're sitting in a classroom, and one of the walls, Nancy Bailey said, when we were working on this wall, the people working on this wall were from 9 different countries. So how cool is that, you know? And so it was brought together, and a lot of it was like they could rent the building for different events. We've had meetings from all over the county, all over the country. In fact, Hamilton County is second in Laotian population in all of our 99 counties here in Iowa. And that's because our churches here have brought people after the Vietnam War and their families and friends and other people from their villages come and join us here. They have interesting stories to tell. So Chin is one of our immigration people. Chin and I have been to a paralegal law class where we have learned to become qualified paralegals. And this ACE is becoming recognized by the Department of Justice to help people on the legal pathway to citizenship in a recognized sort of a way. And so she was from one of the families that came over, and her father, who lives next door to us in ACE, he was fighting with the U.S. soldiers in the Vietnam War. And so after the war was over, his home and him and he himself were targeted by Cambodia to be destroyed. So he was hidden in the jungle for several months until U.S. soldiers brought him supplies once a week and a little bit of money until he had enough money. So they walked like 19 days or something to Thailand, and they crossed the Mekong River in the middle of the morning with the guns blazing above them and went to a Thailand refugee camp. So Chin is one of the little girls that came with her family that way, and Asbury Methodist Church helped them to come here. And since they were here, and he was like the shaman and the mayor of his community, other people have come here that are popular. So Webster City is the home of this group of Laotians. There's only one other place that this group of Laotians at, and I think it's in Canada. And so sometimes they have big meetings here, international meetings here that we don't even know about. But they happen here, so I know about them.
Well, we have Doug Bailey on the line now. Hello, Doug. Are you there?
I sure am.
Good. Welcome to KHOI's Local Talk. Now, do you remember being part of that international work crew that Janet describes?
When I became involved was Diverse Cultures Committee. I think that was close to the name of it. But that was a local group made up of a couple county health nurses, public health nurses, some folks from the school district, and another person or two, I think, from early childhood. Not a large group, but that is the group that initially drew me in.
How did you get involved? What led you to be interested in this, Doug, and respond to the need?
What led them to me, I guess, was our local Webster City Rotary Club had done a drive to secure medical equipment to send to a city in Peru where my son was an exchange student at the time. And the public health nurses came to me and said, well, if you're interested in working on international projects, we have these Laotian folks right here in Webster City who need a lot of help. And so that's kind of where my involvement began.
Now, what were some of the needs you saw among these folks?
Well, and my wife was a middle school instructor at the time, and she would come home and tell me of the issues that were there, the problems, the roadblocks. So I started paying a little more attention to her, I guess, after the public health nurses came to me. And a lot of it did revolve around school and the kids being able to fit in, even to attend. And more often than not, once they were reaching the eighth grade, they were dropping out, and there really wasn't much from home in the way to keep them at it, to keep them in school. And for days on end, children would be staying home. Maybe they were sick initially, and the school was working as hard as they could to get the kids into school. It was just a vast cultural divide there. Most of these parents, especially the initial refugees, had not gone to school. And what school they may have attended was only in the UN camp in Thailand.
So you're talking about folks who really had no tradition of lengthy schooling in their own lives, and so it was hard for them to understand and motivate their own children to continue going to school. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. That is right. They just didn't understand the need.
Now, can you date that for us? When was this all happening? When you first began?
Well, when I became involved, it would have been 97, 98. Somewhere along in there.
So a lot of these folks who were children at that time, presumably now are parents themselves, and if they're living in the area, I hope they're giving a message to their children that school here involves more of a commitment and long-term attendance.
Yeah, absolutely. That piece of it has completely turned around. Completely turned around. And now you have these little kids who I became familiar with through ACE now being moms and dads and now showing up at the parent-teacher conferences and their kids are playing football and they're playing soccer and the girls are playing softball. I mean, they're in. They're in. It just took some effort to make that happen.
So they're now Americans with all the same values, concerns, and teenage fads of any high schooler or middle schooler in Iowa. Is that correct, Doc?
Hey, I would say so. And the sort of the downside to that, in my mind and in my heart, has always been that they have tended to lose that history. How in the world was it that they ended up here in Webster City?
Yeah, that's really a challenge for the older folks to preserve that culture. And I was wondering about that sort of thing. Now, particularly with religion and a church attendance or any of the things they may have brought with them from Laos as a cultural background that tied them together with their own culture, how much of that survives? Are a lot of these folks involved in church or their own religion or social things to draw them back into the culture somewhat?
Well, there is a local Lao church that is a part of the Missouri Synod Church, a local church here in Webster City. A fairly small congregation, and so I don't know that has it certainly has been a piece and it is a stabilizing factor, and some attend other churches.
So now, one thing that I'm sure that still exists in Webster City for them and for Americans who are assimilating in their own way is Laotian food. Is that right?
Yes.
There's got to be a Laotian restaurant.
Well, there was for a short period of time recently, for just a few months, and that has always been something that has been a topic of discussion, just something that finally was started by one of the very young individuals from the community. And it just did not quite make it.
Well, I bet someday there will be, because it's a question of who has the talent and ability to sustain a business. And there's certainly going to be a demand for that sort of thing, because I know there are Laotian restaurants in Des Moines and all over the place, so Laotian food must have some appeal to everybody. That's,
yeah,
that's an idea whose time will come, I think.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Actually, we'll have a little more about Laotian food later in the program, because there are places you can get Laotian food out at All Cultures Equal, and that's another story. But when I was talking to Doug the other day, he told me a couple of things that I found quite interesting that haven't been mentioned yet. One was the importance for the Lao community to have a large space where they could have funerals. And what did you have to say about that?
Yeah, I sure can. That way back then, when we started figuring out, discovering that actually a location, a building was needed, that was one of the key needs, is that when there was a death in the community, and that death actually might occur outside of the community, that it could be someone who was living in California perhaps, but there would be a week-long grieving funeral process. And at that point in time, 99% of the Laotian community lived in the trailer court that is adjacent to where All Cultures Equal is located. And having a week-long gathering in someone's small trailer and people coming from throughout Webster City and also other locations, primarily Minnesota, that did not go over well with the trailer court management and the neighbors, and always ended up in problems that typically resulted in the police having to come, and it was a very unfortunate and unmanageable situation. And so having a place where they could gather, where there was plenty of parking and a kitchen to prepare food, was a real need. And All Culture is Equal, the building, has been used for just that several times since its building. But that was something that was recognized as a big issue.
Now, you also got involved on behalf of your church, Doug, the Asbury Methodist Church in Webster City. Now, are churches still involved with this center?
Churches are still involved in a manner of providing funding. I don't know beyond that. I mean, there would be individuals from churches who would be physically helping out. But I think from Asbury's part, other than some individuals, I think it's probably more financial. I know our current pastor has taken that upon in his heart to help.
Well, now, what about the local Hispanic community? Have you been involved with them also?
Yeah, about the time that we were getting ready to start the remodeling project, was about the time that the Hispanic community really began to grow in Webster City and in the area. And initially, there were folks who would come, make some money, and leave. And in the late 90s, the early part of 2000, 2001, 2002, people were tending to actually move in and make this their home. And so, although when we started, we were primarily just looking at the Laotian refugee population who was here, it transitioned into, and we made connections with some of the key families and individuals who were coming from Mexico and Central America. And they then became also a part of the construction project.
So now, Doug, what's your current involvement with the center and all these activities? Has that changed since initially you became involved?
Yes, it has. My role, see, now is more one of providing some support in my position as a county supervisor. I always have my eye out, so to speak, for the refugee and immigrant population within the community, within the county, and within the area, and I think that has been more my role now from a little higher level, I guess.
Well, it's really useful for you to have that experience and that background when you're part of the county supervisors, because you're really a voice in many ways for these minority populations, and you have a real understanding yourself directly from being involved to actually make the case in many ways for these folks. So I think you're a pretty valuable resource, Doug.
Well, I appreciate that. I think I have a different perspective that I can bring to any table that is involving the immigrant population. And it does require a different perspective, a different way of looking at things.
Well, I think that's true, yeah. You know, and I really think that what you've done has been remarkable, and the center and the history is very significant because, you know, what really keeps America going in terms of keeping us young is the immigrant population. I saw some figures on all developed countries and how many of the populations are, well, the mean average age is getting so high, particularly in Japan. It's really an aging population. And what makes America unique is our melting pot, you know, where we have people coming in, young families, people who bring down the age median here in Iowa and in America. So we are not an aging developed country in terms of the mean average age of the population, and that's due to immigration. It always has been, and every immigrant group seems to have the same experience, the same trouble assimilating, and the same ease, really, eventually, for the generation following to become Americanized. Everyone's playing soccer and baseball and using American slang, just like my mom became an American more than her Norwegian mother. So life goes on, and America is still a melting pot, and we all eventually, in spite of any xenophobia that's out there, accept populations that are new, and they become Americans themselves. What a wonderful American story, and it takes place right in Webster City. And, Doug, you have been an integral part of that, so congratulations for that.
Thank you, and I think the success is, and I was telling this story just the other day, that on this ballot, this general election that we have coming up, we have three individuals who are running for the ISU Extension Council, which that you have to be on the ballot. You have to secure enough votes to be on that. And this year there are two people of Hispanic descent on the ballot, and a Laotian gal who I can remember when she was a very little girl. She attended the homework help program that my wife was the first instructor for out at ACE before the building was even done. And now she is running for an elected office.
Well, that's wonderful, and that's the ultimate assimilation. Thank you, Doug. This has been a feature talking about the All Cultures Equal Center in Webster City, Doug and his Doug Bailey and his involvement with it. Thanks very much, Doug. Have a good day in Webster City.
Thank you.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, hosted by Paul Wearson and Susan Franson. And we've been visiting with Doug Bailey, an active volunteer with All Cultures Equal, or ACE, Community Center in Webster City. Earlier, Janet Tering, is it Tering?
I think so.
Tering, okay.
Tering. She's Norwegian. She told me that she grew up in a town near Story City.
Well, I should know how to pronounce it better than that, Tering.
Yeah.
That is Janet Tering, Executive Director of ACE, and she told us how the center was first conceived to serve the Lao community.
It is now a broad educational and cultural center for many aspects of the community. Let's get back to Janet for a description of why it is seen as a practical necessity before we talk to Peter Fisher, author of Immigrants in Iowa, an economic report for the Iowa Policy Project.
Our immigration office is going to grow and grow and grow because of all the industry around here that may be hiring and are hiring people. So on Second Street, which is our main street through town, in an informal survey, we counted 16 places that are owned or managed or hire a significant number of employees that are from other countries. And right across the street from us, we have Webster City Custom Meats and Marianne Specialty Meats. And just between those two places, you know, we have about 300 immigrant people. So working at that. And Prestige is supposed to bring a plant up by Eagle Grove, which isn't very far from us. And that's supposed to bring more people. And so when I have community conversations, I can't talk about politics and stuff. But I said, you know, if you want to do something to help, we have 1,600 people here that work or live here, the 1,600 people in your county, you be careful who you vote for. Because if they're gone and they can't work for you anymore, the economic well-being of this county is going to go, and this state is just going to plummet. You can't have anything on your plate that hasn't been touched by an immigrant person.
When you say here, do you mean only in Hamilton County or in the whole country?
On the whole country.
After hearing from both Deb Brown and Janet Turing about the economic impact of immigrants on Webster City, I wanted to talk to an economist with hard data to see what that shows about the costs and benefits of immigrant labor in Iowa. I found what I was looking for in a report, Immigrants in Iowa, What New Iowans Contribute to the State Economy, by Heather Gibney and Peter S. Fisher. I was fortunate to get an interview with Peter to give me a summary of this technical report. Let's listen. I'm speaking now with Peter Fisher from the Iowa Policy Project. The reason that I contacted you was that I had encountered a couple of towns in Iowa with significant immigrant populations that were very welcoming and grateful to those populations. And I wondered what the economics of this were, because part of it is just really nice to know that Iowa people are welcoming the immigrants who come to them. But there has to be some counter to this, oh, the immigrants are taking our jobs. So why did you prepare this Iowa Policy Project paper?
Well, at the time, which was a couple of years ago, there was actually immigration reform legislation that appeared like it might have a chance at the federal level, and we thought it was important to understand what that might accomplish. And in order to do that, you needed to have some background on actually what the immigrant population in Iowa looked like and the ways in which they contributed to the Iowa economy, the kinds of public services they could avail themselves of, even undocumented immigrants, how they're limited in terms of public services, and then how they contribute both as workers, as entrepreneurs, and as taxpayers.
And how would you summarize what you found?
Well, I think one of the most important things to recognize is that for the immigrant population, a significantly larger share are of prime working age, between 20 and 65. If we look at the overall Iowa population, about 60% are of prime working age, with the immigrant population is about 80%. So there are not a lot of seniors who may be needing more health services. To a much larger extent, the immigrant population are people who came here for work, and they are of prime working age, and they're working, they're earning wages and salaries, and they're spending money at the grocery store and the gas station like everybody else.
And were there any things that would counter some of the myths that people have? Are they mostly, though, low-paid jobs?
Well, they're pretty much, you know, across the board. There are, of course, because we're looking at government statistics, for the most part, what we have to do here is include all immigrants. In other words, people, residents of Iowa who are not born in the U.S. So that includes legal immigrants and undocumented immigrants, people here on work visas, et cetera, the whole range of immigrant population. And a larger share of them have less than high school education, generally in lower paid jobs, but also they're more likely to have an advanced degree. So we're looking at some professionals who have emigrated to the U.S. and living in Iowa with master's or PhDs. So they're at both ends of the spectrum. But generally, they earn a little bit less than U.S.-born families at the same education level. And part of that is going to be because of those immigrants, certainly those who are undocumented are more vulnerable in the workplace. It's been shown over and over again they're more likely to be victims of of wage theft, and they're more likely to be in insecure jobs with high turnover rates, et cetera. And so that would bring down the average wages of those families, those with less than a high school degree. But I think that, you know, one of the more interesting findings is when we looked at it, we found that immigrants, even undocumented immigrants, are paying probably about 3/4 of the taxes that U.S.-born citizens would pay in the state of Iowa. There's this idea that they use public services and don't pay any taxes, and that's pretty far from the truth. In fact, they pay property tax and sales taxes just like everyone else. So they may have kids in the public schools, but schools are supported by property taxes. Immigrants rent houses. They may own a house, rent an apartment. They're paying property taxes just like anyone else, and that's what supports schools. You know, overall, there are going to be more workers per school children among the immigrant population because they're predominantly age 20 to 65. And there's a long list of services for which they're ineligible. So the services for which they are eligible account for about 3/4 of the state budget, state and local budget, but they're paying about 3/4 of the taxes. So, you know, it comes out about equal in terms of tax contribution versus what you get out of it.
Well, that 3/4 of the taxes, you mean 3/4 of the taxes per capita, surely.
Right. They pay, the average immigrant family making between $20,000 and $40,000, for example, is paying about 75% of what a U.S.-born family would pay at that income level. Because they're among the undocumented immigrant population, there are probably about half who are paying income taxes and half who aren't. But they're all paying sales taxes when they go to the store. They're all paying property taxes. So it's not that they don't pay any. They pay a little bit less, and they get a little bit less in public services.
Well, one of the things that I remember from the report that you haven't mentioned yet is Social Security. They're paying FICA, and their employers are paying FICA. And, of course, even legal immigrants may not be permanent residents and may not stay here and ever collect on that Social Security.
Yes, that's right. So the immigrant population definitely is helping to shore up Medicare and Social Security, because if they work, they're paying those payroll taxes, and the employer is contributing on their behalf. But many of them are never going to benefit from those programs. That's right.
Did you do any part of your study about entrepreneurs and the businesses that they start in some of the small towns?
Well, I mean, we know something about that because we know that a lot of immigrants do start small businesses. They take advantage of what they learn in their home country, and they start a grocery store or a restaurant or, you know, any number of other kinds of small retail businesses. And, you know, they're a pretty entrepreneurial bunch overall, and they always have been. And if we look at, you know, immigrants and their role in the U.S. economy historically. And if you look at how states grow, you know, there's a lot of attention paid to the big Microsofts and Googles, and they come to Iowa and we give them hundreds of million dollars of tax breaks for a handful of jobs. But most of the job growth actually comes from new small businesses, from entrepreneurial activity. And that's where immigrants historically and today made quite a contribution.
Si la conociera, tal vez comprendiera por qué estoy así. Si me mira, me la triza. Si se mueve, me estremece. Yo estoy que me vuelvo loco y me rompo el coco a veces. Ay, bonco, si la conociera, tal vez comprendiera.
That was some music to get us in the mood for a little international food at the Legacy Learning's Wild Winter Weekend, which will feature Cooking South of the Border, coming up on March 18th at ACE Center on East 2nd Street in Webster City. Here's Maureen Siemens to tell us about it.
We are offering Cooking South of the Border with the Legacy Learning Boone River Valley Group, and the instructors will be the persons who are involved with All Cultures Equal, which is a local support system that we've had in place for many years and part of our welcoming arm of the community for an immigration population. So they are going to be providing Cooking South of the Border, which will be on March 18th, a Saturday, and they're also going to be doing traditional Lao cooking on March 11th. And for the Lao cooking, we're going to have Ann Shinoy, Shen Maikio, and Lynn Kunan. And they are noted for their egg rolls and their delicious Lao food. It's just wonderful food. They're just luscious. And they're going to share their recipes and share their cooking techniques in a very hands-on learning environment. And you'll end up sharing lunch. And that will actually be March 11th.
Now, in Webster City, if people want to repeat these recipes, they can go to the Lao food store. Is that right?
They can.
But no Lao restaurant?
No, not a separate restaurant, no. Although they cook fairly often out at All Cultures Equal for different events.
Is there anything else you could tell me about the Legacy Learning's interactions with the immigrant community?
We have offered in the midwinter time slot, it must be our second year. This will be coming on our third year of having a cooking event of from one of our local populations. And some of you might not know that Hamilton County is actually fifth in Hispanic population out of all of the Iowa counties. And so we have a lot of friends in that community, and they have stores and restaurants, and they often gather at All Cultures Equal and have cooking events as well. Or, like, we had a salsa fest just 2 weeks ago, and everyone, including longstanding community members, everyone cooked up a pot of salsa and came out for a friendly competition, and everybody shared the results of their efforts and lunch, and other persons who were not competing actually prepared the lunch, so you could actually have a lovely Hispanic lunch while you were out there checking out on the salsa.
I think that ends our tour of Webster City. But before we talk about out in the county locations for the Ames Artist Studio Tour, I'd like to visit one more town with a large immigrant population. That's Hampton in Franklin County. Hampton is about the size of Story City, about 4,000. But it is the county seat of Franklin County, and it has a 30% Hispanic population. Let's hear what Newton Grutzinger for the Hampton Chamber of Commerce told people at the Iowa Retail Summit last spring. This is a vivid illustration of the general picture that Peter Fisher was giving us. Well, I noticed that you stress on here that it's a diversified community. So you have a large ethnic population?
Yeah, we have somewhere close to 30% Latino population in our town. La Luz Hispana, which we work very closely with. As a matter of fact, Sister Carmen is on our board with the chamber. Just had what they called Grand Festival. That was the first weekend in June. And unfortunately, they can't see the pictures that are up here, but you can see it was very colorful. We had a great time when they were in town, and that was fun. There's a number, and it's wonderful because a lot of our storefronts that would possibly be closed are open because they're very entrepreneurs. And we have a number of Latino restaurants and stores that are open downtown, and we really appreciate that.
But now it's time to talk about something in Story County, the Ames Artist Studio Tour. I recommend going on the website for the Ames Community Arts Council to see the work of various artists and the locations of their studios. I picked out three I know might be missed because they're out in the county. One is actually maybe illegally in Ames, but is still not within walking distance of downtown like many of them are. And so we have little selections that were prepared for us by Connor Keenan, an intern for Ames Community Arts Council. Let's hear the one for Chakati Art Glass. That is in Napier, and it's enough out in the country that you might tend to skip it unless you'd actually seen some of Art Sakati's glass, which is based on some of the techniques for Venetian glass.
Intern for the Ames Community Arts Council inviting you to our Ames Area Studio Tour October 8th and 9th. October 8th and 9th, 20 Ames area artists will open their studios to the public for an inside look at great local art. Here's a little bit about artist Art Coletti and his studio. Art grew up in California and went to college at Iowa State, which is where he discovered his love of creating. It was in the glass blowing club that he developed an interest in his art form that helped shape his life. After graduating, Art built his first studio in Ames. After a few years, he moved a few miles outside of town where he could have more space, and this is where you'll find his studio today. It was interesting to learn from him that a knowledge of welding is necessary to successfully hand blow glass. Art has personally built most of his heating equipment in his studio. His current favorite technique is called a switched axis. This is a method of glass blowing during which you switch the axis point, making a swirl shape in the colors. The process is tedious, but it's also very rewarding, and the final product is well worth it. Art understands that most people do not realize the investment that it takes to make a piece of glass. This is not only with regard to the massive equipment and stock it requires, but also the complicated, choreographed dance a glass blower must learn in order to heat and successfully shape the glass. During the studio tour, Art hopes visitors have a true wow experience. Blown glass is something we do not see very often. He's also excited for people to become more aware of his location outside of Ames so that he can gain more customers. If the studio tour dates do not work out for any visitors, Art also has workshops during the winter. He would love to see you. To learn more about Art, please join us on our Ames Area Studio Tour from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, October 8th, and noon to 4 p.m. Sunday, October 9th. And don't forget about the after party from 6 to 9 p.m. at Alluvial Brewing Saturday night. For more information, please visit www.amesart.org. www.amesart.org.
Okay, and KHOI is one of the studios that you can visit on this tour. So stop by at those times, and we'll be here to show you our studio, and you can see our murals. We have a couple of murals. But one more I want to mention, though, another place though that is outside Ames. We'd love to have you come by our 410 Douglas location, but if you happen to be up in Story City, Molly Nagel at the Upper Story Studio, she's the one real out-of-towner on this tour, and I think that she deserves a little extra attention because of that. She's a fascinating artist. She makes a lot of very unusual pieces, as particularly the animal masks that you may have seen at the All Species Equal events here in Ames. And so, Paul, you can get over and see her studio.
Yeah, I have to confess, I haven't been up to see Molly. I know Molly from being on committees with her. She's very active in the community. But I've got to get up to her studio. She's an artist who is self-sufficient and does a lot of teaching, too. So you can go to Molly's studio and learn how to do art, and that would be fantastic for anybody.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Your hosts for today have been Paul Wearson and Susan Franzen. Our feature story was The Immigrants Who Have Found Homes and Futures in Central Iowa. We spoke with Deb Brown, Janet Turing, Maureen Siemens, Doug Bailey, and Peter Fisher. We wrapped up this hour with a discussion by Connor Keenan of the Ames Artist Studio Tour.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Thanks to Ron Carson for posting the audio of our programs on our website, along with relevant links to today's stories and information about our guests. And you could like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was El Coco from the CD Salsa Cubana, The Gold Collection.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. And if you would like to join the team here as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoyfm.org.
If you enjoy the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.
Salsa mexicana, ay, qué ritmo.
Esa es la